It is Monday, November the 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Turkey's election and what it says about the country's secular past.
Secular past was as artificial as you may call the movement lurched towards religiosity now. The fact of the matter is it's the same people.
Also ahead, the deadly Al-Shabaab attack in Somalia, plus seeking a path to peace in Syria. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, or AKP, pulled off a surprisingly big election victory in Sunday's parliamentary polls, the second in less than 6 months, prompting accusations of voting irregularities from some opposition politicians. For some analysis, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Zubair Iqbal, a scholar at the Middle East Institute here in Washington, who says he agrees the election outcome was a surprise.
Everybody was expecting some sort of a hung parliament, the way it was earlier. But I think two important things happened which led to this result. One of those was that some of the violence that took place actually scared many of the people who had gone on to the Nationalist Party to come back to the AKP. And the second thing that happened was there was a conscious realization that you have to have a powerful government, a more secure, stable government, which can last there for 5 years, to be able to take care of some of the new issues that have started to develop.
What will this do for Turkey's secularist past?
Well, the secular past is an interesting issue. Secular past was artificial, as you may call the movement lurched towards religiosity now. The fact of the matter is it's the same people. Their trend and tendencies in their attitude towards the government or to governance itself is very much a function of which side of the bread is buttered for them. They're very realistic, they're very pragmatic people. And therefore, I don't see that this leads to shifting away from secularism. What I see is that it tends to reflect a degree of ratcheting effect on the movement in one or the other direction. So it could very well be that with increasing closer relationship with the European Union, this kind of a development and evolution would in fact may be a good thing in the future.
What about the Kurdish insurgency? What impact might it have on that?
That's a very difficult question because, you see, we now have in the region contradictory objectives. Every country seems to have contradictory objectives. So much so, as Henry Kissinger said, here is a situation where enemy of your enemy is not your friend. In fact, he's your enemy too. So we have a problem on our hands. Here is a situation where the Kurdish objective or the Kurdish problem is not a unique problem anymore. What Kurds do for their own sake tends to create problems for the region and for Turkey. And if Turkey is in difficulties, it will not necessarily support the allies on the Islamic State. So if you look at it that way, then there is a problem. Because originally the expectation was that IS will take care of the Kurds and therefore the Turks will be able to play sort of a moderating role. That didn't happen.
Well, Turkey is also facing a flood of refugees from Syria and the battle for Islamic State. How might the election outcome impact those two issues?
The only way I can see it is that Turkey will now be able to position itself much more effectively with the European Union people, particularly with Germany and other countries. And therefore, it may actually lead to a situation where Turkey may be in a position to restrain the flow of refugees to Europe, and in exchange, there may be some sort of a rapprochement from the European Union, and therefore, it could very well be good for the chaotic situation as we see today with respect to the refugee movement to Europe.
Zubair Iqbal is a scholar at the Middle East Institute here in Washington. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Twenty years after Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was gunned down by a Jewish extremist opposed to his negotiations with the Palestinians, Israel is more divided than ever over Middle East peacemaking. Repeated attempts to make peace have evaporated, leaving bouts of violence in the wake, including the recent unrest at a holy site in East Jerusalem revered by both Palestinians and Jews. Many have died in the resulting violence. VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with two Middle East scholars about all of this. Natan Sachs is a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and Raith Olmari is a senior fellow on the U.S.-Israel strategic relationship at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Here's Carol Castiel.
Before I ask you both questions, Raith, of course, is a Palestinian by birth, and Natan is Israeli by birth, but either one are not speaking on behalf of either side, but rather bringing to bear their keen insights of both populations. So first to you, Raith Olmari, what is your reaction to the current spate of violence in Jerusalem, and to what extent do you think efforts to diffuse these tensions will take effect?
To look at the effectiveness of efforts to defuse, you have to understand what caused this. On the one hand, we had the trigger, what's happening on the Aqsa Mosque, the Temple Mount, the fears that this engendered in everyone. But this came on top of an already tense situation, a tense situation whereby, let's put it this way, my generation, people who were born in the 60s, 70s, 80s, we remember Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat's handshake in the White House. We remember hope. The generation that was born in the 90s only remembers failure. And therefore, this comes after years of occupation and a Palestinian public that feels no particular hope of things moving forward. And complicating this is the failure of the Palestinian leadership to provide a model. The Palestinian Authority has been suffering from corruption and mismanagement and really has no program to its public. So this is the complex reality. In the short term, what we saw recently with the attempts to defuse in the Temple Mount will certainly help bring the temperature down. But unless we deal with the root causes, we are bound to face these kinds of incidents over and over and over again.
Turning to you, Natan Sachs, for your take on the current spate of violence, the root causes as well as the more proximate ones.
As I had said, I think it's a combination of both. We have, on the one hand, proximate causes, tension over Temple Mount, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and Temple Mount, or Haram al-Sharif in Arabic, is wider than just the mosque itself. It includes also the Dome of the Rock, where two Jewish temples stood thousands of years ago, and in a sense encapsulates the conflict more than anywhere else. It's the holiest site for Jews, but barred for entry for most Orthodox Jews. But it's also one of the most holiest sites for Muslims. And as a result, it's been the focal point of clashes many times in the past. In particular, the Second Intifada was sparked by a visit by then-opposition leader Ariel Sharon, Israeli opposition leader, to the Temple Mount. And time and time again, in fact, if we go back to the 20s, the 1920s, then to the first spates of violence, long before there was an Israel, had to do with what was then called as well the status quo around the Temple Mount and the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, just to the west of the Temple Mount. And so this is the proximate cause, and it's been a powder keg for a long time, the holiest site in the region, and one that brings this conflict from a national place to a religious place, a very dangerous one to my mind. But there's a wider context, of course, and the wider context is the stalemate, the very deep sense of impasse on the diplomatic side. It's not just that the two sides failed to reach peace, it's that more and more people on both sides, especially the Palestinian, but the Israeli as well, are now feeling that there really isn't much hope of a two-state solution in this near future or perhaps ever. And therefore, there's kind of a sense of puzzlement of what might come in its place. The general sense and the general fear is that more of the same is what's coming now. And this leads to despair, what Raith also described on the Palestinian side. For Israelis, too, a sense that this isn't going anywhere much and that there's not much point to diplomatic efforts. It boils down, in a sense, to what we're seeing now, a very troubling situation, one especially focused on Jerusalem, which is a unique situation. Unlike the West Bank, which is divided between Israeli rule and Palestinian rule, but most Palestinian people are ruled by the Palestinian Authority, in East Jerusalem, Israel has full control, but it's not fully incorporated into Israel. And as a result, we have a bit of a no man's land, and that's where we're seeing the violence right now.
Natan Sachs is with the Brookings Institution. He and Raith Olmari of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, speaking with Carol Castiel, who is host of the VOA program Encounter. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website, voanews.com, and look for Encounter under the Programs tab. Still ahead, deadly violence in Somalia and the push for peace in Syria. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America, hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Salih, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Salih saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for a deadly attack on a hotel in Mogadishu Sunday that left at least 12 people dead. Authorities say the militants set off a car bomb at the entrance of the Safahi Hotel in Somalia's capital. Following the blast, gunmen stormed the hotel, which is popular with government officials and business executives. All the attackers wearing Burundian military uniforms were killed by security forces. Also killed was General Abdikarim Yusuf Dagabadan, a former army commander who led the offensive that forced Al-Shabaab to retreat from Mogadishu in August of 2011. Two Somali lawmakers also died. At least 11 Boko Haram militants were killed Sunday in separate attacks on Chadian army posts around Lake Chad on the Nigerian border. Reuters reports at least two Chadian soldiers were also killed. Before being killed, one of the militants detonated an explosive device, wounding 11 civilians. Chad is part of a multinational force formed to destroy the militant Sunni insurgency centered in northern Nigeria. The son of deposed Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi appeared in a Tripoli courtroom on Sunday to face murder and repression charges related to the 2011 uprising against his father. Saadi Gaddafi had sought refuge in Niger but was extradited last year. He is accused of killing a member of Tripoli's football club. Another Gaddafi son, Saif al-Islam, was sentenced with eight others to death in July for crimes committed during the uprising. Pope Francis on Sunday voiced great concern over a new outbreak of sectarian violence in the Central African Republic. Speaking to an audience in St. Peter's Square, the Pope appealed to all the parties involved to put an end to the cycle of violence, called for compassion and reconciliation. But he left the impression that his planned trip to the country on November 28th and 29th could be canceled if the violence worsens. At least four people were killed last Thursday in the capital, Bangui, bringing the death toll to 11 in the past week. It forced planned elections in October to be postponed to December. The country descended into sectarian strife after the Muslim Salika Alliance seized power in March of 2013. In other news, the United States says it used the recent international talks in Vienna on Syria to pave the way for a future without President Bashar al-Assad. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Syrians need more than the choice of Assad as their leader or submission to the Islamic State militants, often referred to as Daesh.
We have to eliminate the mindset, which was encouraged from the beginning by both Assad and Daesh, that the only choice Syrians have is between the two of them. You either have terrorists or you have Assad. No, that's not the choice.
And about the same time that the Syria peace talks were taking place in Vienna, the Obama administration announced it would deploy a small group of troops to Syria. For more, International Edition's Jim Stevenson speaks with VOA's Michael Bowman about that deployment and how political types are reacting.
The United States is going to be sending about 50 commandos on the ground in Syria, not to actually battle Islamic State, but to help train and boost the fighting capabilities of the moderate Syrian rebels who are fighting the Islamic State. This from an administration that takes great pride in having withdrawn American forces from various combat zones. Nobody saw this coming. It quickly became fodder out on the campaign trail among those who are vying to replace President Obama in 2017. It was interesting in that neither on the Democratic side nor on the Republican side were there wild cheers of enthusiasm. It definitely was not extreme reaction either way that one might expect.
We have about a dozen Republican candidates, really three on the Democratic side, and you have almost maybe as many different opinions on the subject in reality as you do candidates. Interesting that at this point, nobody's really making, you know, a lot of waves about it.
Indeed. I mean, let's be clear, 50 commandos is a very small number.
Yes.
Here. I think at the height of the war in Afghanistan, we had well over 100,000, ditto in Iraq, taking part in direct combat. This is a very small deployment. Hillary Clinton said that the idea has merit. Which is about as faint a praise as you could possibly give.
Right.
but very quickly said that there should be no massive ground forces in the area taking part in combat operations. Bernie Sanders hopes that this isn't the beginning of some mission creep where we eventually do have combat forces on the ground taking part in combat missions. And he said that we should be avoiding another quagmire. Republicans for years have been saying that we should have intervened in Syria sooner, not by directly taking on President Assad or by directly taking on Islamic State, but by establishing a no-fly zone, more aggressively arming those and backing those who are doing the fighting. And they say that the situation has gotten out of hand because essentially the United States stepped back and let all sorts of things happen in Syria. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, I just think that if for nothing else, the symbolism of a president who was elected specifically on the promise that he would keep America out of costly conflicts that sort of go on without end, to see him come around on something like this, even in a symbolic way, I think made a lot of people sort of cock their heads and say, wow.
And perhaps in reference to the costly basis, 50 really is not a large number, like you say. It's a small group of highly trained people going in. But symbolism is a big deal, definitely during the campaign season for president.
It is. And we have to keep in mind that this comes at a time when Russia is taking a more assertive role in Syria, doing a lot of bombing. Presumably, these commandos will be out of the way of Russian bombs falling in Syria. What happens if the very people that these American special forces are training come under direct attack, direct assault? Do these commandos offer no help whatsoever? What orders are they under? Mm-hmm. I suspect that we'll have to wait and see how that plays out.
That is VOA correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with my colleague, Jim Stevenson. It is time now to check out what's trending online, and our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is here. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. Hope you had a nice start to this month. Sunday was the World Vegan Day, and that hashtag is still trending here in America.
G, before we get into the details, tell us about the terminology first. So what's the difference between a vegetarian and a vegan?
Sure. There are different levels of being on a plant-based diet, but put it simply, vegetarians still eat some animal byproducts, so that includes eggs, dairy, and honey. Vegans, on the other hand, don't consume anything deriving from animals, including the ones that I just mentioned, but they also don't use leather, fur, silk, etc. They even don't use cosmetics and soaps made with animal products, and you'd be surprised, a lot of conventional personal care products do contain animal products.
I understand. So what is the best account to follow to learn more about World Vegan Day?
There really isn't any. There is an account on Twitter at World Vegan Day, but the last tweet was back in 2010. So I suggest using the hashtag to search rather than following a specific account.
Oh, that would be timelier for sure. So what are some of those interesting tweets related to the day?
Steve, interestingly enough, an infographic from the IDF is getting a lot of attention on Twitter. And I am talking about the Israeli Defense Force. I know that's really confusing, but here's why it's trending. The IDF, at IDF spokesperson on Twitter, explained how the military is catering to people who have different diets. The infographic showed that vegan soldiers can receive additional money to buy breakfast and dinner, but they will always have a vegan option for lunch. and they can also receive boots and beret that are non-leather and non-wool. But of course, not all results from hashtag World Vegan Day search showed supportive messages. Some Twitter users actually used the hashtag to show pictures of their steak dinner and crispy bacon for breakfast. That's all for me today.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. If you'd like to follow G on Twitter, her handle is at G. Abby Lee. You can also find us, International Edition, on Twitter. We're at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A group of Canadian researchers have developed a quick and inexpensive way to test for hepatitis B and male infertility. They say that their new paper-based DNA test could especially be helpful in diagnosing these unrelated but serious conditions in developing nations. Writing in the Journal of the American Chemical Society, the researchers say that within 10 minutes, their new test can detect an early-stage hepatitis B infection in a patient's blood serum. This is something that would give medical professionals valuable time to develop a proper treatment plan before the infection can spread. The same test can also be used to predict male fertility by checking the DNA integrity of sperm as precisely as current proven testing methods. The researchers say that their new diagnostic test can be made from materials that cost less than $1 per device. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. An award-winning film written and directed by an Ethiopian tells the story of a young Ethiopian girl who was caught up in her rural village's tradition of abducting girls for marriage. This is a true story and helped to make illegal the kidnapping of young girls for marriage, one of Ethiopia's oldest and most deeply rooted traditions. Here's VOA's Kim Lewis.
Defret means courage in Amharic. It's the title of an award-winning Ethiopian film inspired by the true story of Aberesh Bekele, a 14-year-old girl who in 1996 was abducted on her way home from her village school. The kidnapping of women for marriage was common in the country. However, Aberesh fought back, and in her attempt to escape, she killed her would-be husband. She was charged with murder and stood trial for 2 years. With the help of a tough and passionate lawyer, Meze Ashinafi, Aberesh became the first woman in Ethiopia to be acquitted of murder based on self-defense. Zeresine Berhane Mahari is the writer and director of the film. He describes what motivated him to write the movie, Defret.
I left Ethiopia in 1996 in May, and this particular story happened a couple of months after that. And I returned 8 years later, and I had a chance to meet the lawyer who defended Aberesh, the young girl. Just in a conversation, it came up and what she does, and I wasn't aware about her organization, Ethiopian Women's Lawyers Association. It was first of its kind. It's a non-profit NGO that gives free legal service to women and children. So I just couldn't put it away. The things that she had to go through to get this organization going, and one of the big profile cases that she handled was this abduction case that happened. So I knew that I wanted to make a film about it.
Zeresine says the story of Aberesh is not unique. In his research, he discovered that thousands of young girls are abducted for marriage in Ethiopia and in other countries around the world. Zeresine said it took a long time to bring Aberesh's story to the big screen. He wrote the screenplay in 2008 and began shopping the script around in Hollywood, California. However, Hollywood had different ideas on how to cast the film.
We had some really interesting offers from producers in Hollywood who wanted to make the film first in English, and then they wanted to cast some famous actors to play the lawyer especially, and they wanted to shoot it outside of Ethiopia, which I was not comfortable with.
After the project was finished, it was shown to Hollywood actress and director Angelina Jolie. She embraced the story and became the movie's executive producer. Jolie has an adopted daughter from Ethiopia, and Zeresine said Jolie's thinking was that Aberesh could have been her daughter. He says the film is also a story of hope.
Women had to stand up to old traditions, and they can fight it in the court of law. They can fight it in the mass media. They can fight it in the opinion polls. And this was something that, for the first time, families in Ethiopia had to sit down and talk about.
Zarisane says because child abductions are prevalent throughout the world, it is his goal that others with similar stories get to have a voice by seeing their own story on film. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And many thanks to Kim. Kim is the host of Africa News Tonight. You can hear it right here on The Voice of America. Thank you very much for that. A reminder, that film is out there. It's already opened in New York. It'll be opening throughout the United States and around the world. So you want to be sure and check it out. How about a little sports news? It turns out that Kenya's Stanley Biwott and Mary Keitany swept the titles at the New York City Marathon. That happened on Sunday. Keitany became the first woman to repeat since Britain's Paula Radcliffe did it back in 2008. Biwott won his first major marathon title after placing second in London last year. He finished in 2 hours, 10 minutes, 34 seconds, beating countryman Jeffrey Kamworor by 14 seconds. Close win. Keitany finished in 2 hours, 24 minutes, 25 seconds. She beat Ethiopia's Asolech Mergia by 67 seconds. Super congratulations to all. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This year's International Religious Freedom Report makes clear that governments are not the sole perpetrators of religious freedom abuses. Indeed, some of the worst persecutors of religious minorities are violent extremists and terrorist organizations. The terrorist group ISIL expanded its territory in Iraq over the last year and proceeded to commit horrendous atrocities against religious minorities and others in areas under its control. We are unlikely to know exactly how many Yazidis ISIL has massacred for some time because mass graves are still being discovered. But estimates are in the thousands, with at least hundreds killed simply for refusing to convert to Islam. Many Shia, Christians, Sunnis who disagree with ISIL and others have also been killed or driven from their homes. On both sides of the Iraq-Syria border, ISIL sought to eliminate or enslave those who it assessed as deviating from ISIL's own violent interpretation of Islam. It has forcibly displaced hundreds of thousands of people, conducted mass executions, and kidnapped, sold, enslaved, raped, and/or forcibly converted thousands of women and children. In Syria, the terrorist group al-Nusra Front conducted targeted executions of religious leaders, including 7 Druze clerics in Dara province and Jesuit priest Franz van der Lucht in Homs. Al-Nusra Front also kidnapped priests and nuns on multiple occasions and engaged in bombings and other religiously motivated attacks. People living in northern Nigeria, the far north region of Cameroon, and southern Chad and Niger were subject to terror and destruction as a result of Boko Haram's quest to impose its religious and political beliefs throughout the region. The group deliberately targeted Christians as well as Muslims who spoke out against or opposed their radical ideology. In Pakistan, violent extremist and terrorist groups attacked houses of worship, religious gatherings, and religious leaders, causing hundreds of deaths during 2014. In Burma, abuses of religious freedom included societal violence against religious minorities, including Rohingya and other Muslims and Christians. Governments around the world must take decisive action to prevent violence, harassment, discrimination, and other abuses against religious minorities. In the case of ISIL, the United States is working with 65 coalition partners to take the fight directly to the terrorists and defeat them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.